Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're joined in studio by our Director of Field Outreach, Eric Stegman.
Nice to be here.
So, Eric, we've been looking forward to having you on the show for a while because you are an expert on native as well as rural poverty, something that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. But we are finally having you on because we have an excuse to have you on that's especially timely, which is Canada.
Oh, Canada.
And we're going to get musical with it, apparently. That was lovely, Tracy.
Why,
that was
thank
golf
you,
clap,
Rebecca.
Golf clap, golf clap, golf clap. So Canada is in the news this week because of an overwhelming vote in favor of the Liberals and Trudeau coming in to end up actually leading Canada in something that was not necessarily expected. Tracy, what happened and why do we have Eric here?
Yeah, so Trudeau is part of the Liberal wing of Canadian politics. We claimed a little bit of the victory because we had him at CAP 2 years ago to talk about economics and middle class.
Clearly, that's what put him over.
Hesitate to post that as soon as he was elected.
I noticed that video went up pretty quickly.
And so this was, I think, an exciting thing for progressives the world over because it was an indication that if you run on progressive politics, you can actually win. And something that was particularly interesting at this time is that there was an influx of Native parliamentary members. And Eric, you take that away.
I think the reason we're excited to bring Eric in is because there's been a lot of attention paid as there should to the fact that the Liberal Party campaigned heavily on an anti-poverty platform, things like a child benefit. This is something that CAP has been pushing for a while now, an increased investment in the early years of life. We put out a child tax credit proposal along those lines. Those kinds of pieces of this story are getting told, but the piece that's getting ignored is the Native piece of this. Eric, tell us what happened. Why is it notable that natives turned out for this election and ended up being elected to parliament?
Well, I think it says a lot about progressive politics in Canada. One of the things that's interesting up there is that there are several parties competing for the progressive vote in Canada. And we saw a lot of people turn out, both for the Liberals but also the New Democratic Party, all of whom really share a lot of the same values. And it was really exciting to see this political shift after many years of conservative policymaking. For First Nations people up in Canada, which in Canada tribes up there are largely referred to as First Nations, they turned out in droves. And I think there were a couple of things that were that this was due to. One of the biggest is that we had a lot of Native candidates who were running for members of the House of Commons in Canada. So we had actually 54 different Indigenous people running, mostly through the Liberal Party, but also some in the New Democratic Party. And we actually had a record 10 who were elected to Parliament.
And so that's out of how many?
That's a very good question. Something I'll have to check into.
We'll check the Google. But 10 is a lot.
Right. It's a lot. It's definitely more than we have here. But it's I think part of it is that there was a lot of good on the ground organizing among First Nations communities there where they really saw themselves represented in the political system and particularly in the progressive side of this election. So that was really exciting. And, you know, one of the things I thought that was so interesting that really said a lot about how Native people turned out in this election is that in around 5 or 6 First Nations communities, they actually ran out of ballots. And that's a lot of people are up there thinking it's because they actually underestimated the number of people who were going to turn out. I was actually just reading an article this morning in the CBC that said that in Manitoba, in northern Manitoba, which is primarily Native people, they actually had 11,000 new people turning out. And in quite a few of the First Nations precincts, they had increases of like 20% in largely low turnout precincts. So.
Now, this is a particularly interesting topic for you because your family was part of one of the First Nation tribes that straddled the Canadian-U.S. border. And you wrote a piece recently that said, First Nations in the Canadian election, three takeaways for Native Americans in the U.S. So given, you know, I'd love to hear actually a little bit about your family's history in the area and why you think that there's great parallels for tribes in the U.S. from what occurred in Canada.
Sure. I think a lot of the tribes and the First Nations that are on both sides of the border, a lot of people who are familiar with those communities are around them don't understand that a lot of families are actually on both sides of these borders. In many cases, some of these reservations actually straddle the border, literally, so you can walk across the reservation and end up in Canada. And so there are a lot of values that we share, family systems, but a lot of the issues are the same. And I think one of the things that I brought out in our piece is that unfortunately a lot of the disparities are exactly the same, and you'd think that, you know, where Canada really sort of outshines us in some ways, in a lot of the issues that relate to First Nations and tribes here in the U.S., the disparities are exactly the same. There's a horrible crisis of suicide among Native youth on both sides of the border. The child poverty rate is almost the same. About half of First Nations children are in poverty on the reserves. And on reservations here in the U.S., about 47% of children are in poverty, which is compared to 21% nationally. So a lot of those disparities are very similar. And so I think it's interesting to sort of look at what the political shifts that are taking place on both sides of the border that are tackling issues that are the same for people who actually have family that, you know, span both sides.
I have confirmed that there are 413 seats in Canada's parliament, uh-huh, if you include both chambers.
So 10's quite a bit for Native people. So hopefully we'll continue to increase that.
Well, so and Eric, you know, just to unpack a little bit more of what you were just starting to talk about, right, which is these kinds of disparities. Native poverty is something that is really a chronic and crisis level problem here in the United States as well as in Canada. Almost never gets talked about. What is it that we are doing about this here in the United States? What is it that we should be doing about this? Talk a little bit about Native poverty for folks who might not know anything about it.
Sure, there are, like poverty anywhere, there are a lot of different reasons that it's as bad as it is, but for too many tribes in this country, and there's about 566 federally recognized tribes in our country, the issue is so chronic and so long-term. There are a couple of major areas, and one of the things I point out to in my piece, the call to action by the principal chief of the Assembly of First Nations in Canada was about closing the gap. And there are such extreme disparities that relate to a couple of these issues, and it's similar down here. One is education. It is unbelievable how different the education outcomes are for Native and non-Native people in our country. The graduation rate for Bureau of Indian Education schools, which service a lot of reservation communities, is 53% compared to 80% nationally. And in Canada, the on-reserve schools there have a graduation rate of 35% compared to 85%. And we all know, you know, we discuss a lot on this program and a lot on our blog and a lot of other places about the importance of education. But I think this is one of the reasons that one of Trudeau's primary commitments, especially with having a majority, was that they are going to pump a lot of money back into K-12 education. In fact, they've committed over 4 years to pumping $2.6 billion of new revenue into the tribal education system up there.
Sort of amazing to think if you graduate, you're the exception to the rule with those kinds of numbers, right?
Yeah, and I think what's especially disturbing when you look at the education rates is this year, fortunately, it was pretty much stagnant for Native youth, but they are still the worst of any ethnic or a minority group in the country when you look at their rates. And for many years, in the past 5 years or so, they were one of the only groups to actually fall back while everyone else's graduation rates were improving. So that's one major area that we need to continue to do a lot of work. And the Obama administration has really been stepping up on this. Recently, Secretary Sally Jewell from the Department of Interior announced some serious funding improvements to Bureau of Indian Education schools, many of which have been subject to yearly hearings. And I really do mean yearly hearings in front of Congress because of ceiling tiles falling on kids, unhealthy conditions, asbestos problems. I mean, these are like bread and butter problems. So we're not even talking most of the time about how to actually improve the education.
And so your piece talks about how essentially candidates should be running on these issues, include them in their platform. What do you think candidates can do to build on the success that the Obama administration has made as they're looking to represent this important constituency that's often overlooked?
You know, I think they can take a cue from the president way back in 2008 when he was running. It was amazing to see a major presidential candidate actually visit a reservation community on the campaign trail and truly listen to tribal leaders and their communities about these issues. And as some of your listeners might know, he was actually adopted by the Crow tribe when he visited back in 2008. And I think, one, personally, he really understood a lot of these issues up close, and a lot of the policies that he may have heard about meant something different when he actually saw how those might change that community. And for him, it became an administration-long priority. I worked in the administration of the Department of Education. I also worked on the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate. And I can tell you there was strong leadership through all of these years on a number of really important tribal priorities that have done a lot to change things. So I really urge any candidates who really do care about tribes in this country to make it a priority to stop in tribal communities on the campaign trail and build policy platforms that are meaningful for those communities, because they're the ones who know what's going to really improve their situation.
And you spoke a little bit about education. You mentioned the suicide disparities, really a horrible counterpart to that as well. What other kinds of policies would you want to see from candidates to show that they are listening and that they get that Native poverty is something that they need to make a priority?
There's a lot that we need to do to improve the entire situation economically for tribes. And for a lot of people, they don't really understand that there are a number of people who live in urban areas here who are tribal members, and then there are reservations which are largely in rural areas. One of the biggest things we need to do is to really help improve economic development on reservations. There are a number of different challenges when it comes to being able to develop economic projects on reservations with access to capital and a range of other issues, and there's some really important policy priorities that have been put out there on that. We absolutely have to make the most out of the new healthcare reforms. One of the things that a lot of people, again, actually don't know about under the Affordable Care Act is that it actually permanently reauthorized the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act. And a lot of the Medicaid expansion funding will go a long way to improving health services for Native people in Indian healthcare facilities. It's going to improve their reimbursement rates in states where they've actually expanded Medicaid. So I urge candidates to look at both existing areas where, you know, we need to be doing things like pushing on states to expand Medicaid to improve Indian health care, while also looking at some of these larger systems reforms that the federal government has a lot of responsibility in to improve economic development.
So obviously a lot of critical issues that can be brought up in the campaign, but we will also need to make sure that Native communities are engaged when it's election day. And you talked a bit about, in your piece, engaging Native youth. You know, what do you think can be done, given this is a growing population, to better reach out to young people, whether they're in urban settings or on reservations?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the things that was really encouraging for me in the Canadian election is that a lot of those Indigenous Native members of Parliament that you saw running, they're very young, and they have a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of inspiration to make some change. And I see the same thing going on here in the U.S. I put a lot of emphasis on the importance of listening to Native youth. The president has really done a lot to jumpstart this, and I really challenge candidates here to take what the president has been doing over the last year especially and mobilize around it. The president has actually put out a really strong Native youth agenda. This past summer, he actually held the very first White House summit on Native youth issues, and he has been meeting with Native youth in tribal communities. Just this summer, he was also out at Standing Rock, and I think it's really important to listen to Native youth and their agenda, because they're also the ones who are going to be our next civic leaders, not just as citizens of the U.S., but as members of their tribes and their future tribal government leaders. So I think it's really important that part of that campaign process really and meaningfully include the voice of Native youth.
So I think this is a conversation, Tracy, I am nominating to have Eric back already, right?
Absolutely.
So that we can have a more substantial conversation about Native poverty and what needs to be done. Eric, where can our listeners go to find out more about Native poverty and some of the solutions that you've been talking about?
Sure. There's two really good resources I'd recommend. The National Congress of American Indians at ncai.org, which is our version of the Assembly of First Nations, and the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute, cnay.org.
And, of course, they can read your talkpoverty.org piece that's out today titled First Nations and the Canadian Election, Three Takeaways for Native Americans in the United States.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be here.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
Domestic violence impacts a significant number of Americans every day. More than one in three women and more than one in four men have experienced rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetimes. Unfortunately, the intersection of poverty and domestic violence is all too rarely discussed. October marks Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so we're joining our allies in raising awareness about the impacts of domestic violence, particularly on financial insecurity.
To discuss this important issue, we're joined by Lisa Len Jacobs, Vice President of Government Relations at Legal Momentum, an organization dedicated to ensuring economic and personal security for women and girls, as well as Dana Bulger, Executive Director of Know Your Nine, a national survivor-run, student-driven campaign to end sexual violence across campuses in this country. She's also a columnist at Feministing.com. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks for having us.
So I think we're going to start with you, Lisa Len. So a lot of people who aren't familiar with this issue often ask why a survivor just doesn't leave an abusive situation. But as you know, it's more complicated than that. How does poverty factor into a survivor's decision about whether or not they can leave?
Absolutely. So I think the thing that people sometimes miss when we're having these conversations is how interrelated a couple's finances can be. Oftentimes, if we are talking about issues associated with domestic and sexual violence, we can be talking about a victim who's somewhat of limited means and as a consequence may not have the same number of options. Perhaps the survivor, and I don't want to suggest that the survivor is always female because that's not the case, but the survivor or the victim may share expenses with the abuser. And if that relationship breaks up, they might not have the amount of money that they need for rent, for childcare, for other kinds of things that keep their lives stable. Perhaps, and we saw this, I think, a year ago when the Ray Rice case came to the fore, perhaps the survivor is dependent entirely economically on the abuser. And in that case, separating from them means economic insecurity and uncertainty for themselves and likely for their children or other dependents.
And when you raised that example, that was one of the first things that popped in my head, because a lot of people were like, well, why doesn't she just leave? And I think people expected maybe for her to create an exit plan. Well, you know, save up some money and leave. Why is that, I guess, a poor take on a situation?
I think that for many survivors, they're living day to day, right? An abuser is often someone who is acting to keep their lives unstable. If I have a job, my abuser may call and say things to my employer to make me look unstable, you know, to suggest that, you know, I've stolen or that, you know, I'm going to call off work and not warn them or just a variety of things. My abuser may abuse me the night before I'm due to go on shift, leaving me in a posture where I do have to call in at the 11th hour. And so the way in which the abuser is manipulating the situation has the survivor constantly in a posture of responding to that. So the ability to stop and step back and make a plan, which is one that we very much recommend, particularly if someone is planning to leave a relationship, because we know that is a moment where the violence can escalate. But still, the ability to stop and do that is a luxury that often the survivor does not have.
And Dana Bolger, I want to bring you into this conversation as well. Much of the media narrative when it comes to violence in this way focuses on campus sexual assault. That's sort of a hot topic right now, particularly given some of the interest from the White House and the vice president's office. But when the media talks about campus sexual assault, it often focuses on expensive colleges and perhaps well-to-do appearing students. So poverty doesn't really seem to be an issue in the context of campus sexual assault. Is that the case? Is that an accurate portrayal?
Absolutely not. I think the media's portrayal here speaks a lot more to what kinds of victims and survivors the media believes the American public can sympathize with. But in reality, sexual violence is not just a problem at so-called elite, expensive colleges. It's a problem at state schools, community colleges, technical schools, and in middle and high schools. I think it's also important to point out that the impact of campus sexual assault hits marginalized students the hardest. So students who are dependent on scholarships are often required to maintain a particular GPA. That's something that can be difficult to impossible to do in the wake of violence, particularly if a survivor's school isn't providing the victim the support and accommodations that they need to stay in school free of charge. I think finally, it's really important here to think long term. So we know that a college education has become increasingly necessary to secure financial security throughout life. For students who drop out of college as a result of sexual violence, as many do, they struggle to get jobs, they get lower paying jobs, and they end up stuck in hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt.
And as someone who works with survivors on the ground, not just sort of studying this in a kind of an academic perspective, as we often do here at the Center for American Progress, what are some of the cost barriers that students who are survivors of sexual violence might face to accessing and completing their education?
Oh, all sorts of things. Transportation costs, food, property damage, security expenses, relocation costs. I think two of the most significant costs that I hear regularly from student survivors are the costs of mental health services and tuition. And both of these things can really intertwine and exacerbate each other. So students who can't afford to access mental health support services and aren't receiving it from their school often end up dropping out of school. For other survivors where dropping out is not an option, they earn lower grades and are punished long down the line. One survivor I spoke with earned lower grades in the wake of violence and was ultimately expelled as a result. And 7 years later, she's still facing hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt.
So Lisa Lynn Jacobs, you know, similarly, it's really expensive to be a domestic abuse survivor when you're out of school as well. So there's the relocation costs, the needing access to medical care, counseling, missing work, as you mentioned previously. What are some of the policies that we need to put into place to make sure that experiencing violence doesn't drive survivors into poverty?
So, again, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and we tend to see a renewed focus or a deeper dive on that. Well, one thing that we're looking forward to this month is the reintroduction of the federal bill that focuses on the response to the economic needs of survivors of violence. It's called the SAFE Act. The acronym is Security and Financial Empowerment. The bill has for many years had a powerful champion in Senator Patty Murray from Washington State. And then on the House side, it has been a bipartisan bill with Congresswoman Lucille Roybal-Allard of California and Congressman Ted Poe of Texas. So that bill has what I often like to call a three-legged stool, although it's being a little bit revamped in this Congress. But briefly, there are 3 to 4 key provisions. One is an anti-discrimination provision so that we don't see survivors get fired just because they're survivors. Often employers view them as complicated or not wanting their drama in the workplace and they get fired. And that, as we've already discussed, means that their engagement in that relationship, which they might want to disentangle themselves from, is going to be sustained. So that's one piece. The second piece is leave. to enable them to have that moment, to do the safety planning, to change locks, to move, to do other things to help them gain the stability that they're going to need. The final of those big three is unemployment insurance, because as we know, sometimes a survivor, and the way in which the bill focuses is not only on you're eligible if you're the survivor or if you live in the household with the survivor. So if, for instance, your child is being subjected to the abuse and you need the leave, you're eligible. If you need unemployment insurance because you or someone in your household is being subjected to violence, you're eligible. There are some other provisions in there that focus on insurance discrimination, because often what happens is if you own a house and your abuser sets your stuff on fire or otherwise vandalizes your household, there's a police report, the insurance company finds out about that, you may be dropped, your rates, your premiums may go up. So in lines of property insurance and life insurance, the bill would also bar that kind of discrimination.
And you've pointed out just how much domestic violence really impacts every aspect of your life, I think, ways that many people might not anticipate.
Yes.
Now, what are some of, I guess, the most common myths that you think are perpetuated about domestic violence out there that maybe we need to clear up as you know, we push the SAFE Act forward?
Sure. I think that if you survey, in fact, I know because I've seen them, if you survey employers, they will say to you, domestic violence is a big problem in the workplace, you know, at the 90% and above level. At the same time, if you have a one-on-one discussion with an employer, he or she does not believe that domestic violence is a problem in his or her workplace. They acknowledge there's a problem. They think it's happening somewhere else. Yet, what we know is that for 25% of women and about 17% of men, workplace violence is going to be an issue. Or when I say that, I mean you're in the workplace and you're concerned about violence that has happened to you, or maybe the perpetrator is going to come to the workplace. Those concerns are real for a quarter of women and nearly 20% of men at some point in their career. I think the other key thing to acknowledge, which employers don't, when they get really focused on the victim and is she showing up or he showing up late, et cetera, is they don't focus on the fact that they're also employing the perpetrator. The perpetrator tends to be more invisible. They don't need the kind of accommodations that the victim does. But what the perpetrator is likely doing is using work time and work, if you will, accessories, work technology, to keep track of the victim. They might use your laptop, your cell phone, or your company car to figure out what's going on with the victim. They might turn to a coworker if both the perpetrator and the victim are in the same workplace. They might turn to a coworker and say, for instance, Dana, I know that you're, you know, going to walk across the facility. Let, you know, Joe know that I'm going to see him at lunch, right? Joe has now gotten what I will refer to as the dog whistle about how the perpetrator is keeping track of them and using colleagues. And Joe's probably going to be concerned now about whether or not disclosures are being made. That, I think, is a very big problem in the workplace, that survivors are very worried employers are going to find out and going to view them as unstable or otherwise not a good employee and fire them as a consequence.
And Dana Bolger, do you feel that there are myths out there about campus sexual assault that we should also similarly clear up?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things I would say. First, I think there's a myth that the only form of sexual violence that's happening on college campuses is rape and sexual assault. We know that dating and domestic violence are problems on campus. We know that stalking is a problem. That isn't making it into the popular media narrative about the issue. Second, I would say people continue, despite survivors' testimony time and again, to insist that the solution here is the criminal justice system. We know that that's not true. Student survivors have told us that were there cases turned over to the police without their consent, they wouldn't report to anyone at all. That means campus administrators, too. And that obviously will have consequences for student safety on campus if perpetrators are able to remain on campus without any accountability. But it also has real consequences for survivors in terms of obtaining the services and accommodations that they need to stay in school. If they can't go to a Title IX coordinator and say, I need free counseling services because they're afraid that that report is going to go to the cops, then they're not going to get the mental health support they need.
Well, and the criminal justice piece of this is something we absolutely want to talk about, in which it's broader than just the campus side of things, right? So I want to bring you in as well, Lisa Jacobs. We've seen some very high-profile media stories that get discussed in the context of criminal justice, but sometimes the DV side of things gets left out, and people might not even realize that's a piece of the story.
Right.
A great example which comes to mind is Marissa Alexander. She mm-hmm. was the Florida woman who fired a warning shot, and the reason she was firing a warning shot, despite the fact that it almost never gets talked about in talking about her story, the warning shot was to her abuser. Don't come near me, right? I'm trying to get away. She was prosecuted. She was ultimately sentenced. She's now on house arrest and serving out a sentence for having done that. But that was an example of the criminal justice system, I would say, and I think we probably would all agree, failing a survivor in this situation. What can we do better as a society, whether it's through the criminal justice system, whether it's not through the criminal justice system, to ensure that survivors can actually access meaningful justice?
Well, I think it's a very timely question, right? Just as the country is having this discussion about Black Lives Matter and policing and police reform and accountability, I think training is key here for not only law enforcement, but prosecutors and judges, and really engaging people about their biases. I was reading an article today where a Mississippi judge said, this is nearly a quote, that he believes that in his courtroom, people accused of a crime are criminals, right? We have a criminal justice system that determines that. Yet at the outset, this is a judge who has a view, who has a bias about the people who are coming before him and expecting impartial treatment. I think what we really saw in the Marissa Alexander case was concerns about what went on with the prosecution, right? Prosecutors have the ability with mandatory minimums, which were in play in that case, to compel people to settle rather than going to trial, to basically say to them, if you're convicted, you're going to have to go to jail for 20 years. Instead, take this 3-year plea. So what happens is that people who are victims, who sometimes are not even accorded the privilege of being viewed as a victim or the privilege of having a right of self-defense. And that happens disproportionately with survivors of color and survivors at any intersection, LGBT survivors, immigrant survivors, all of them are much more likely to be subjected to some kind of bias at some point in the system. So the system has the ability to compel people in their own interest to settle for a smaller sentence, whether or not they are innocent, whether or not they actually were engaged in defending themselves or sometimes a loved one or a child.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. We're talking to Lisa Lynn Jacobs and Dana Bolger. Dana, same question. What do you think we can do to ensure that the criminal justice system is working better?
This is maybe a little bit of a sidestep to your question, but I think that one of the key steps here is to expand civil options for survivors that are fully responsive to the effects of violence. One of the things that I think we're learning from the campus context, or at least, you know, articulating in the campus context, are that the harms of violence go so far beyond the purely physical. There are educational consequences, there are financial consequences, psychological and emotional consequences, stigmatic consequences. And accordingly, our responses to these harms need to be comprehensive. So they need to address these educational consequences. They need to address these financial consequences. Title IX provides a clear pathway of how to do this in the educational context. Title VII, similarly, in the employment context. And I hope that we can expand these sorts of options and resources for all survivors.
Well, and can we talk a little bit about what Title IX is? It's in the name of your organization, right? So give us a little bit of a primer. What is Title IX? What relevance does it have for this conversation?
Sure. So Title IX is a 1972 civil rights law that prohibits sex discrimination in any educational program receiving federal funding. And over the last four decades, courts have come to understand that rape or sexual violence constitutes sex discrimination and is a civil rights violation, and that as a result, schools that receive federal funding need to take action to both act to prevent it and respond to it after it occurs. So think about it. If your rapist sits next to you in math class or lives in the next dorm over from yours, you're going to have a hard time learning. You're going to have a hard time going to class. And that's what we see over and over again. And that is why Title IX is such a powerful tool for survivors.
Are there lessons from the campus movement, this question's for both of you, that can be brought to bear to benefit low-income people who are outside of the campus infrastructure? Because it seems like it's a movement that's gained a lot of momentum.
Absolutely. 200% yes to what Dana just said. Often we talk about the kinds of civil rights remedies that are available to survivors. We also call them restorative justice remedies. They're focused on how do you make a survivor whole? How are you responding to what the survivor needs, as opposed to the criminal justice system, which is focused on accountability, generally criminal accountability for the perpetrator. So we are very much having these discussions, particularly in low-income communities, which again can, you know, have a greater or lesser percentage of people of color in them, who have concerns about reaching out to law enforcement in general. They may be afraid to call law enforcement because it could bring harm to themselves, to their partner, to other people in their household. So as a consequence, we often encounter survivors in that context who want to see some level of accountability for the perpetrator. They don't necessarily want it to involve law enforcement. So maybe it involves them sitting down and working out an arrangement around child custody, around other areas where their lives may continue to overlap. Maybe it involves an agreement for the perpetrator to go to some sort of batterer's intervention program or some kind of diversion program that does not involve immediately someone is arrested. Someone who may very well be contributing to that household economically is then pulled out of that equation, and then what you see is a family that's economically unstable as a result.
And same question to you, Dana. Do you feel that there are lessons learned from this campus movement, which you really are one of the leaders in driving, when it comes to the larger conversation around best practices for survivors?
We should be having this same conversation that we're having about college campuses in high schools and middle schools. This is a problem there. This is a problem that affects all students, and most schools, any school that's receiving federal funding, is required to address it. So let's talk about what happens when a high school student is photographed or videotaped being sexually assaulted, and then that video is circulated to the entire school, and that survivor needs to transfer to another school in the district and pay additional transportation costs. This violence is impacting younger students, and I think the best thing that could come out of the college conversation would be to continue and really expand the conversation to middle and high schools.
We've been talking about the criminal justice system a bit, and the recent criminal justice reform bill that was introduced will increase mandatory minimum for intrastate domestic violence crimes. Do you think that this is the right approach?
You know, we are so fortunate, and one of the things I have not talked about is that my organization works beneath a huge umbrella entity. So we work with lots of state and national organizations, including Know Your Nine, on issues around, for instance, reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. So when we talk about the Criminal Justice Reform Bill, what that means is we have really strong relationships on Capitol Hill with lots of congressional offices. So we are having discussions both with them and with the White House, really related to what I just said about what goes on in communities that are afraid to reach out to law enforcement. The National Domestic Violence Hotline has done a very recent survey talking to people who call in, and significant numbers of them say, you know, I called the cops and what happened was I was arrested or I was threatened with arrest. So we understand that we need to figure out what an appropriate response looks like in communities that are, as we put it, and I'm saying this in quotes, over-policed. So we're having that conversation with Capitol Hill. I believe the Senate bill is going to get a vote in the Judiciary Committee tomorrow. The House bill is still moving through. So we're involved in discussions to talk about what the most useful ways to go forward are on that provision and with other supports for survivors.
And Dana Bolger, do you feel like this is the right approach?
I think Lisa Lynn has hit on all the really key points here. The criminal legal system is just not an option for so many survivors, and in fact is criminalizing so many survivors. Who do you turn to when the person that is supposed to protect you is an agent of violence against you? And I think just to add to that, that it's important not just to think about the harm that the criminal legal system is inflicting on many survivors, but also the real limitations of it. We know that there are so many harms of violence and so many costs. And again, I think that expanding civil options to support survivors is a really strong alternative here.
Well, and I'd love to get into a little bit more detail about that, right? Because I think people assume sometimes that the criminal justice system is maybe the way to handle this type of issue. We're hearing from both of you that maybe it's not, or maybe we need to rethink that. And you've both referred to the need for alternative resources mm-hmm. and policies. You mentioned, Lisa Jacobs, the SAFE Act. Mm-hmm. Are there other concrete policy solutions or best practices that that should be lifted up and that should be getting more attention?
Sure. One of the things my organization and others are looking at is the question of how, particularly for young women and young women of color, they find themselves engaged, if you will, with law enforcement in the first instance. We find that for so many young women of color, whether or not it is that they are a victim of sex abuse or domestic violence, whether or not they witness it, whether or not they are in an over-policed community or one that's experiencing a lot of violence, first of all, there's a lot of trauma there that's undiagnosed and unaddressed, and what that may cause then is somebody who's sitting in school who literally is not emotionally or otherwise ready and prepared to be there. And without the appropriate kinds of supports, the counseling that Dana was talking about in the campus context, that can put them either at odds with or in friction with the administration at their schools. So they then can find themselves policed. They get detention. They may be suspended. If they're out of school, they can then get charged for being truant, et cetera. And we call that the school-to-prison pipeline.
But an under-discussed component of it, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So very much what we are trying to look at is to figure out what kinds of services and supports that particular piece of the community is experiencing. Because what we also know is that if someone witnesses or experiences domestic or sexual violence when they are young, that puts them at greater risk as they progress. So trying to figure out how to address that piece is one challenge. And then I think on the back end, for people who we were talking about, like Marissa Alexander or others who find themselves as victims, nevertheless incarcerated, trying to figure out what services and supports to render to them, either while they are incarcerated or once they are being reintegrated into community, is the the other piece of that discussion.
And I'm glad that you said also for victims who've witnessed violence, mm-hmm. because yes. I think we've been talking a lot about the people who maybe have directly experienced the violence, but we know that young children exposed to violence, it genetically ages them,
yes.
it slows down their cognitive development. So there have been some wonderful examples of preschools, actually, one in Chula Vista, California, where they have counselors on hand to
right.
deal with children who are witnessing domestic abuse. So obviously the policy solutions will go beyond just the maybe victim who is firsthand experiencing the violence, but also to the witnesses. But I'd love to hear from you also, Dana Bulger, about some of the policies that you think that we can be implementing.
Yeah, I think it can sound crude sometimes to talk about the financial costs of violence. But it's so important that we do so. Lisa Lynn has spoken so eloquently to ways in which these costs can prevent survivors from leaving abusive relationships and really paralyze them. So one solution that I've heard is improving and creating private civil rights of action for survivors both on and off campus. So these allow survivors to sue their perpetrators for money. Which, again, can sound so crude, but is actually so critically important.
I have one more thought, if I may, and that information, I think, is likely available on both Know Your Nine's website as well as Legal Momentum's. But if people in the middle school, high school, or higher ed context feel like their rights have been violated, they can file a complaint with the Department of Education and their Office of Civil Rights. So I would urge you to share that contact information as well, because they can understand the process of filing a complaint and get that information online.
We absolutely will. So we are so grateful for your time today. Lisa Lynn Jacobs is the Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum. And Dana Bulger is the Executive Director of Know Your Nine, a national survivor-run, student-driven campaign to end campus sexual violence. Thank you so much for this very important conversation. I hate to even be able to say this sentence, but I hope our listeners take away that that sexual violence can be both a cause and a consequence of poverty.
Thank
Absolutely.
You both for joining.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio. It's time for the weekly worst. Tracy, do we have Alan with us?
I think we do. Is that the serious?
Oh, that's
why you ask Tracy?
Right there.
I'm 3 feet to your left.
For dramatic effect, Alan. I was trying to make you seem
Do you
seem
think people
legendary.
Forgot that Tracy's also here in the last ad break? You gotta start trusting your listeners, please.
It was
please.
A long
please.
Ad break.
Please start trusting your listeners.
I'm not our weekly worst's keeper.
We're not gonna process that right now.
Anyway, so
Alan,
if people don't know, Alan joins us from Think Progress every week to give us three news stories related to poverty and progressive politics, and we vote on which is the worst
three
of the week.
Bad news stories.
Bad news stories.
Important modifier.
Oh, well, hopefully we vote on which one's the worst of the week.
Hopefully they're well written. Just, yeah, okay. All right. First of all, Congressman Paul Ryan has said that he's only going to run for Speaker of the House if his colleagues agree not to infringe on his time with his family, which is an admirable sentiment, and one that a woman in high office probably wouldn't be able to get away with, unfortunately.
But that's not what lands us in the weekly worst. It's the fact that he's voted against policies to ensure that everybody else in the country can get protection for their own family time. He's tried to cut funding for child care subsidies a number of times in his budgets. And also in 2009, he apparently voted against a bill that would have provided 4 weeks of paid paternity leave to new parents who are federal workers.
Yeah, you dove right in.
I love this one. This is great, right? Hypocrisy points all over the place. I need time with my family. Oh, so do American workers.
I feel like there's this weird thing that happens in Congress when they're like, well, you know, it's different when it comes to me. You know, I think I should get a pay increase, and I think I should be able to spend time with my family. But, you know, my job's different than, you know, you poors out there.
Well, we people in Congress, we work really hard.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, okay, gold star for you, Paul Ryan, for acknowledging publicly from a position of power that this is an important thing.
Right.
And in addition to your gold star, I award you 4 bags of cow shit. Because, like, you can't vote against policy moves that would bring us in line with literally every other country in the world except, like, 3. Every other developed country in the world except 3.
And apparently his own values.
Right.
This would be like if he said, I will only take this position if I can get a pay raise of X amount.
Right.
But he was also voting against the minimum wage increases.
Right, exactly. Right. And you brought up Gold Star. I think a lot of people were particularly annoyed with Sheryl Sandberg around this as well, because she gave him a shout out on Facebook saying that the Lean In Award of the Day goes to him for this, when actually I think he's been making it so a lot of people have to lean out. I don't know. What's the opposite?
Particularly working women.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. What's the next one? We could go on, obviously, for a long time on that one.
Even though Ryan just won 4 bags of cow shit, which is unprecedented on our show. That was the first cow
shit
award.
I'm going to award some more of them.
And I would have had to pretend to know who Sheryl Sandberg is if we had kept going.
Wait, what?
That's a joke.
Wait.
That's a joke.
Okay, all right,
that's
keep going.
You guys looked horrified. Wow, that was awesome.
That's story number 2.
Not as horrified as if you hadn't known who Shania Twain was, but we know you do, so continue.
Alabama.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the band, not the wonderful country band that was ripped off unfairly by a pop act that I won't name.
That's a separate episode.
No, an Alabama circuit court judge named Marvin Wiggins is making headlines after the New York Times reported that he instructed hundreds of low-level offenders who owed court fines that they had to give a pint of blood at a blood drive outside his courtroom if they couldn't pay their fines out of pocket that day. For anybody who didn't comply, Wiggins said, quote, "The sheriff has enough handcuffs." Now, jailing people for being too poor to pay fines on misdemeanor charges is sadly not all that new in America, and we've been covering a lot of these modern-day debtors' prison stories on thinkprogress.org in the last couple of months. But this is the first time I can think of that a judge literally ordered impoverished people to pay their debts in bodily fluid or get put behind bars.
Yeah. So when I read this, my mouth dropped and stayed open for longer than it humanly possible.
Longer than ever before. It's yes. Open so much, Tracy.
My jaw drops a lot on this show.
Shout out to the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's getting involved in this and who is, I think, challenging what the judge did. So we should probably have them on the show at some point to talk about that.
Absolutely.
But I will say the sad fact is, as explicit as he was about infringing upon people's basic and constitutional rights in this particular case, this is so not uncommon in terms of the desperate measures that people have to go to in order to pay these kinds of fines and fees that they can't afford, and that they will go to prison if they don't pay. This is just the latest way that courts are getting blood from a stone.
And just denying basic humanity. And I quote my...
You can't end on my dramatic blood.
I'm sorry.
Did you just compare poor people to rocks?
Moving on. But I quote my buddy Linda Tirado a lot on this show, but she in one of her chapters in her book, she talks about how poor people are expected to literally sell their bodies
yes.
if it comes yeah, yeah. comes down
yes.
to it. And the fact that this doesn't seem odd at all to this judge is just, mm-hmm. it's horrifying.
It's American exceptionalism.
Terrifying. Exactly.
When I was in Philly and seeing people who were faced with these kinds of fines and fees, they were on the side of the road picking up cans and turning them in for a nickel. They were selling their blood and their platelets.
Right.
They weren't ordered to per se, but they were in effect because they had to do whatever they could.
Right.
There was one guy who was a client of my organization who literally started a small business picking up dog shit from people's lawns, and they would pay him 50 cents to do it, 50 cents a pop, right? So, like, those are the
right.
levels that people are going to pay this. This is finally putting a face on
it. Is this what people mean when they say the startup economy?
I guess that's one way to put it.
Story 3. What do you have for us?
One last thing on that. Sorry. Did you guys see the detail that it doesn't actually wipe out your fines and fees?
No.
It gives you a $100 voucher toward what you owe the court system for such things as, like, I don't know, fishing after dark or out of season or something, or, you know, low-level marijuana possession.
Or driving while black.
Right.
Right.
Good times.
All right. Thanks for clarifying and making sure we know
Alabama.
That the story is even worse than I thought.
Thanks, United States of America. All right. Last up is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons, who's also in hot water with Alyssa, who was just gesturing aggressively in the corner.
Care
and
to add
me.
Something,
no,
Alyssa?
Russell Simmons is in trouble because customers of his Deposit Advance debit card service, which is called the Rush Card, have been unable to access their money for, I think, like 4, 5, 6 days now. They had this is for people who aren't familiar. The Rush Card is a system that lets people who don't have a standard bank account get direct deposit paychecks processed more rapidly into an account that's linked to, like, a normal plastic ATM card. And they changed vendors for some reason in such a way that there's been an outage for days and people have been cut off from their balances. And when they've been able to get back in, their balances have been incorrect. So it's possible that Russell Simmons' company, like, accidentally, technically sort of stole from people and is trying to make it right. They're talking a good game, at least, about trying to fix it. But the sort of the underlying screw job here is these are cards that charge you, like, $1 a pop for ATM transactions unless you agree to a recurring monthly subscription fee to have the card. And all of this, again, stems from the way that traditional brick-and-mortar retail banks have retreated from places where they can't be bothered to do business with mostly low-wage workers.
And also, let's just say that this was an accident. If they, you know, if they make up for it and make sure that people are able to get access to their money, these people have gone days without the money that was theirs. And that sort of thing can drive people into a worse situation.
Right.
You know, these people are living day-to-day often, so they're not going to be paid back enough for going money that belonged to them.
Right, right. Yeah, Russell Simmons can afford to you know, refund you the money that disappeared briefly from your account, but I don't know if he can get you unevicted if you missed rent.
Exactly.
He can't get you unhungry if you had to skip meals and weren't able to cook for your kids and so forth. I wonder how many of these people ended up having to get payday loans.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's probably something that happened across the board. All right, so we've got some serious choices.
Yeah.
Alan, you gave us a really hard one this week.
Yeah.
Right? I know I say
is
that
Is that not my
week.
Job?
That's your job.
I mean, that's your job.
Should I go first? I got my vote. I assume we're voting for the same one. I got to vote for the blood story.
You have to vote for the blood,
you
right?
You got to.
Right?
I think it's just it's
just
horrifying.
Just give me the blood, Eli, so I can get out of here.
Oh, wow. I mean, we're laughing, but we're also inside crying. This story is horrifying. And so that's my vote.
Yeah, it's
vote.
Pretty bad.
That's
it's,
my vote.
The fact that we all have to vote for the blood one just says so much, given that we're voting against Speaker Ryan.
No, you guys go to town on blood. This means I get to cast a protest vote.
Oh, you have
you guys
no.
flex.
Were you go not ahead. Intending to vote on that one? Do you not?
Well, democracy's already settled this. I'm gonna take the soapbox that's been offered to me.
I think I was gonna say I don't think there's any more that we can say. What's your protest vote?
Paul Ryan is an absurd human being.
Do we have to vote on that?
Listen. Here's what drives me so nuts about this is that there are all these other examples in public life of people who have retrograde positions on some social policy. I'm thinking of, like, Senator Rob Portman changed his mind on gay marriage only after learning that I believe his own son, family member for sure, I believe it was his own son, was gay and in a committed, loving relationship. And Portman wrote this really lovely op-ed about this, the effect that had on him. And, you know, it's become a cliche that, like, part of what helped get same-sex marriage over the hump ultimately was the gradual realization across America that, like, well, if it's not somebody in my family, it's my mailman or my bartender or something. And, like, oh, right, these are human beings. And for whatever reason, like, it's aggravating that it takes that much to trigger people's empathy switch in so many situations. But for somebody like Paul Ryan to routinely sabotage the ability of working people of very low means, which he himself comes from that background and ought to know, sabotage their ability to raise their families in a attentive, you know, present from the inception kind of a way, especially as somebody who's so committed, on the record at least, to family values and the idea that the real key to getting out of poverty is just having more dads in their kids' lives. It's great for him. I hope that he's able to extract this awful concession from his Republican colleagues that he'll force them to let him keep spending lots of time with his family. But get a grip, man. Like, you're making national policy for a country of more than 300 million people, tens if not hundreds of millions of whom work every day much harder than you do for a much lower paycheck and have no opportunity to insist upon time with their families, time at home. Of any kind.
And of course, he doesn't stop there, right? He grew up in a family situation where his family was able to make ends meet because of Social Security survivor's benefits. And yet he, you know, loves to propose and support cuts that would be absolutely devastating to people, including children like he was, who rely on survivor's benefits.
And speaking a little bit back to the bodily autonomy issue of poor people, I feel like a lot of people will say that, you know, low-income people shouldn't have children. So this isn't, you know, a problem that they will have to deal with. We've heard that debate
like
so much on Fox News.
People like my new friend from Fox News, Seton
exactly.
Motley. But we're out of time. So I think Tracy and
There's
I win.
There's no way that's a real person's name.
I think Seton Motley begs to differ, but
I want to see receipts. I'm not prepared to endorse this.
You can follow him at Less Government. On that note, Tracy,
great plug.
We win.
Great plug.
We win. You lose.
You lose, Alan.
Come back
Good night,
next
America.
Week. Bye.
And give me blood, Eli, something, something. Right.
That's not the line. Just give me the blood, Eli, so I can get out of here.
The end.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can listen on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the We Act Radio Network, and on Sundays at 10 a.m. East, 7 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and leave us a review, and we'll be sure to shout out some of our loyal listeners on the air. You can also feel free to pitch us on some segment ideas via Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or by emailing us at info@talkpoverty.org.
Special thanks to our producers Alyssa Peterson and Greg Kaufman. We'll see you next week.
And as always, take it away, Chris Stiles.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford 'cause my block ain't safe.